Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening.
Hello, welcome. Welcome to the Bard's Grove.
How are you tonight, Kat?
I'm great. How are you, Lantern?
Oh, bright as day. Bright as day, my dear.
Oh, good. Well, you know, have you noticed how it's getting darker sooner?
I sure am. It is pitch black outside there.
Wow. Well, it's not quite that here on the West Coast, but we're almost at the equinox in 2 more weeks. So there you go.
Yep. Time flies when you're orbiting the sun.
Yes, definitely. Yes, definitely. Very good. So, I thought that since the Pisces full moon is Monday, and we had talked a little bit last week about Virgo, the energy of Virgo being one in which you want to integrate your body, soul, and spirit, and how sometimes we get carried away, like in Rumpelstiltskin, and try to be too perfect. So now with this Pisces full moon, it's much more about how do we balance spirit and matter? How do we understand that spirit isn't about perfection, it's about being true to yourself. So I don't know why, it just came to me. I wanted to tell the story of St. Francis and the Wolf. Do you know that, Lantern?
No, I don't. I'm looking forward to it, Kat.
Oh, good. Well, you know, Pisces is a lot about miracles in many ways. It was during the age of Pisces, which is the last 2,000 years. We're about to end and go into the age of Aquarius in the next 100 years or so. But anyway, the age of Pisces was really an age of miracles. People believed in that God would come into the world and change their lives. And so many of us today are hoping and working so hard on getting conscious and pulling in that God force or goddess force, if you will, and hoping to create miracles in the same way. So anyway, this is the story of St. Francis and the Wolf. You know, there's a town in Italy called Gubbio. It was a prosperous village that had a very great problem. For you see, a wolf was eating their livestock and attacking the people. Nothing the townspeople did could protect them from the wolf. Never had they seen such a fierce predator. He killed a shepherd, then the shepherd's brother and father when they went out to deal with this menace. The next morning, the town was abuzz with the story told by the shepherd's mother and sisters. Well, the mayor of Gubbio decided that he would send 3 of his best guards to find and slay the dragon that very afternoon. At dusk, the townspeople could hear shouts and clashing of metal from the woods. And then it was quiet. For you see, the guards had met the wolf. Late in the night, the only survivor of that encounter struggled into the anxious town and collapsed. After he was revived, he told his tale of their fight with that fierce and powerful wolf. As the story rushed through the town, the wolf grew larger and more ferocious in their imagination, and it put fear into the eyes of everyone in that little town. Children were kept close by, weapons were at the ready, and the defenses of the town raised. Well, the mayor consulted with his advisors, and they decided to see if Francis of Assisi, who wasn't quite a saint at that time, could help them. They had heard that he could talk to animals and that God talked to him. Several brave messengers were sent to find Francis and ask him for his help. They had the good fortune to find him in Assisi, and they told him of the tragic attacks of the wolf and how the frightened people were almost in a state of siege. They thought Francis was the only one who would be able to help them. And they begged that simple holy man to help and implored him to come with them right away. Francis, he had a tender heart, was moved by their plight, and he wanted to do what he could. He said they could leave in the morning and let them eat and rest for the night. And after dinner, they prayed with Francis for a solution, and they slept with the hope in their hearts that things would change. Dawn found them walking down the hill from Assisi on the way to Gubbio. In time, they arrived at the woods near the town. The messengers pointed to where the wolf had slain the 2 guards not far from the road. They stayed in a tighter group as they hurried the rest of the way, watching for the wolf. The gate of the town was opened when they arrived, and it was quickly closed behind them, for the entire town now followed Francis to the town square where the mayor waited for them. Then the mayor invited Francis into the town hall to eat and to discuss what Francis might do about the wolf. Now, the mayor wondered what Francis could do with such a challenge. You know, this mayor, he really hated that wolf. He had known the men who were killed. He knew their families. And one of the guards was even a cousin of his wife's. If he were younger, he would have led the guards after the wolf. And so he really wanted Francis to strike the wolf dead or send him to another town, maybe the one that belonged to one of their enemies. Either would satisfy the need for revenge and stop the attack. Well, Francis listened as the mayor described what had happened in their peaceful town. He had much empathy for the families of the victims and wanted to meet the wolf and hear his story, too. Francis stated that the next morning he would go to the woods where the guards had been killed to see if he could find the wolf. And that night he prayed for the wisdom to find a solution that would benefit everyone. Early the next morning, refreshed and confident that this could work out, Francis was accompanied by the townspeople to the gates of this town. They wished him well, and then they retreated back to their homes, worried that Francis would share the fate of the shepherds and the guards. Well, Francis, he was brave, and I think it was because he always believed that spirit was with him and knew that no matter what happened, he could meet it. And so he walked into the woods, ready to engage the wolf. As he neared the first stand of trees, the wolf appeared and began to stalk him. The wolf's slow, deliberate steps were the walk of a predator, and it certainly announced his intention. He drew nearer and nearer, closing in a circle around the holy man from Assisi. Seeing the wolf, Francis felt a connection, and he made the sign of the cross and called the wolf to meet him in peace under the grace of the Great Spirit. Now, Wolf watched as Francis came closer. "Come, brother wolf, I will not hurt you. Let's talk in peace." And that wolf froze right in mid-step. The wolf struggled with doubt and uncertainty. Finally, understanding that Francis meant him no harm, the wolf walked to Francis and sat on his haunches, ready to listen. Francis told the wolf that he had come from Gubbio and described what the townspeople were experiencing because of the wolf's action. He described the pain and resentment they held towards the wolf. "How did this come to happen? Why do you kill livestock and people?" Francis asked. And so the wolf told Francis his story. He had been left behind by his pack because he was injured and couldn't keep up. He could only catch prey that didn't run fast, like sheep and goats. We see he really preferred to eat deer and rabbits, but with his injured leg, that was out of the question. He explained to Francis that all he wanted was to eat when he was hungry. Francis implored him to explain his actions, and so the wolf continued. The first shepherd he had killed was trying to protect his flock, and the wolf had no choice but to fight back and kill him. That afternoon, two more men came after him, and instinct ticked over. He quickly killed them, leaving their bodies where they fell. And then the next day, three guards came hunting him. He was only defending himself when he fought them, and two were slain. As the third man was no longer a threat, he let him go. Francis could see that the wolf was only acting to fulfill his needs. He had made unfortunate choices that affected the people, but he knew nothing about them. Through Francis, the wolf was able to feel the pain of the people, and that wolf felt remorse. He was sorry for the pain he'd caused. But, you know, he needed to eat. What could he do? Well, Francis prayed. The wolf watched, not really understanding, but sensing that Francis believed in it, that he felt bad about causing the pain. And after Francis came out of his contemplation, he suggested an answer to the dilemma. It was a suggestion that would meet the needs of both the town and the wolf. He proposed to the wolf that the townspeople could feed him, and in return, the wolf would stop killing the people and their livestock. Well, the wolf thought that this would work out pretty well for him, but he worried that the people would still try to kill him. And of course, Francis understood the wolf's concern and assured him that he would present the idea to the townspeople in such a way that he would be forgiven and welcome to the town. He knew they could let go of their fear and hate if they saw the wolf ask for forgiveness and accede to and agree to a peaceful relationship. Francis extended his hand and the wolf his paw. And so they made a pact and walked back together to Gubbio. As they neared the gate, the citizens couldn't believe their eyes. Francis and the wolf continued to the town square, although the mayor and the entire town watched with hate and fear. The wolf had to keep his eyes on Francis to still his own fear. And that's when Francis called out, "Come, countrymen, the wolf won't hurt you. Let's talk in peace. I've spoken with the wolf, and he apologizes for his actions and wants to make amends." Francis told them the wolf's story. "He has the same needs as you and only wants to eat and not go hungry. Can you people feed him if he promises never again to take the lives of the people and their animals? You must practice forgiveness. We must love those who we think of as our enemies, but who perhaps aren't." The citizens were skeptical, but he said, "You know," Francis said, "this will be your wolf. He can't be killed or passed off. He will serve the town as a defender as long as he will live." And so those citizens asked Francis if this were true. And when he said it, they made the pact. And the word spread to other towns. And soon the people of Gubbio were proclaiming proudly that they had a special wolf, Brother Wolf. He lived for another 2 years until he died. He was cared for by the citizens of Gubbio. And that's the story of St. Francis and the wolf.
Excellent.
That's an interesting version of it, and a little more in depth, but as I read it, I sort of heard resonances, you know, with sometimes how we forget that when people are hungry or when people are poor that they can strike out, or when an animal is injured. When anyone is injured, they do strike out. And instead of wanting to retaliate with revenge, maybe we need to step back and say, you know, what's going on? What's going on? I think that's a good idea to think about on this 10th anniversary of 9/11.
I think you have a valid point there, my dear. A valid point indeed. If more people realize that those that they think of as their enemies are just people too, who have their own injuries, their own perspective, and the more we can appreciate others' perspectives, the wiser we all are, that's for sure.
Yeah, and not to be naive, but also to say, you know, this is a balance here that we need to make. We aren't always right, and you're not always right, but sometimes we're right. And so how do we bring that balance together? I mean, even though that feels a little bit like a Libra story, I think it's much more that Pisces story, that miracle. Because really and truly, it's when we have compassion in our hearts that we can understand where the other person or wolf is coming from. And I think that's the Piscean influence. You know, how do we see that we're all one, even though we're all very different and sometimes very annoying?
Sure. Well, I'm going to hop to it and tell you a short little tale about Zabka the frog. This is a Czech tale. And I'm sure you've heard versions of this before. One day, long ago, Zabka, the little frog, was hopping about in the wide, wide world looking for an adventure. He hopped and he hopped, and soon he came upon a wooden bucket filled with fresh cream. He jumped to the side of the bucket. He looked down, and he wondered what kind of thing this was. He smiled to himself because it looked like white water. So he hopped in. That white water felt so cool and silky against his skin. Well, he swam, and he splashed, and he dove. He had a real good time. He swam and jumped until he had enough. Well, now he was tired of the white water. He wanted to go home and go to sleep. But just then, Zabka found that he couldn't get out of the bucket. The cream was too deep for his legs to reach the bottom and jump, and the sides of the bucket were too slippery to climb out. Zabka was thunderstruck. It was hard to believe that a moment ago he was having such a good time. He couldn't bear the thought of drowning. So he kept swimming and hoping he would think of something. The little frog swam to his left. He swam to his right. He swam round and round and round until he was almost too tired to move. And he began to sink. And as he dropped beneath the surface, he sputtered, "No, I will not quit." And he grabbed one big gulp of air and he tried to swim some more. But then, pretty soon, he became too tired to even swim. Zabka stopped to rest again. And once more, he began to sink beneath the surface. Once more, he struggled. He rose up and he carried on swimming. Well, this happened several times, until one time, when he sank, he felt something beneath his legs. He pushed down, and he hopped straight out of the bucket. Without knowing what he'd done, Zabka had churned the cream so long he'd made a large, firm, yellow ball of butter beneath his legs. Zabka the frog.
Very good. Very nice.
Well, I've got another shorty. Would you like to hear another shorty?
Of course. I love your stories, Lantern.
Thank you so much. This is another old Slovak tale. This is called The Fly and the Millet. Once there lived an old man and an old woman. They had a young son. And while they were all so poor, they often had trouble finding food. Times were so bad that finally one day they had only one grain of millet left to eat. "Ivan, take the millet to the miller. Have him grind it into meal," said the old woman to her son. Ivan went to the mill. He had the millet ground into meal. The old woman cooked the millet, put it into a bowl to cool. "Ivan, you guard the millet while your father and I have a rest," said the old woman as she sat down for a nap. The father stretched out to nap on the bench while the old woman sat in her chair. Young Ivan took his job very serious. He stood over the bowl with a large stick, ready to take care of anyone who would dare disturb their last little meal. Well, in just a little while, a hungry fly buzzed into the house and made straight for that bowl of millet. Well, as soon as Ivan saw the fly, he said to himself, "Just look at that fly. I'll fix her for trying to spoil our millet." He snuck up on the fly and swung the stick mightily. He missed the fly, but he did not miss the bowl of millet, which shattered and flew into pieces all over the room. "I'll get even with that fly," thought Ivan. Spying it in the air near the old woman, he began to swing his stick. He missed the fly again, but he did not miss his mother. She fell to the floor, truly asleep, with a big bump on her head. "Now look what you've done, you naughty fly," cried Ivan, as he redoubled his efforts to catch her. The fly sat on the forehead of the sleeping old man, and Ivan again swung his stick. Once more, he missed the fly, but he did not miss the innocent old man, who also fell into a deeper sleep with a great big bump on his head. Ivan chased the fly all over the house, breaking this, upsetting that. Finally, he threw the stick at the fly. He missed the fly, but he did not miss the window. The stick went through it, and the fly followed right after. The fly and the melt.
Very good.
Well, I hope that brought you a little laugh, even though it didn't get you any millet. Well, do you have another one to tell us?
Yes, I do. It's a Grimm's fairy tale.
Ooh.
And it's very, I like to tell stories that are very thematic of our time. And,
sure.
And the Pisces Virgo axis is very much about how do we bring, let's say, magic into our lives. And it takes a lot of discipline. Last week we talked about Rumpelstiltskin, and that was just sort of like bringing magic in, but having something take over. Now this is something that's worked for and yet almost lost. This is this tale of the wishing table, the gold ass, and the cudgel in the sack. There was once upon a time a tailor who had three sons and only one goat. But as the goat supported all of them with her milk, she was obliged to have good food and to be taken every day to pasture. The sons did this in turn. Well, one day the eldest took her to the churchyard where the finest herbs were to be found, and he let her eat and run about there. At night, when it was time to go, he said, "Goat, have you had enough?" And the goat answered, "I have eaten so much, not a leaf more I'll touch." "Come home then," said the youth, and took hold of the cord around her neck and led her to the stable and tied her up securely. "Well," said the old tailor, "has the goat had as much food as she needs?" "Oh, she has eaten so much, not a leaf more could she touch." But the father wished to satisfy himself, and he went down to the stable, stroked the animal, and said, "Goat, are you satisfied?" And the goat answered, "How should I be satisfied? Among the ditches I leapt about, found no leaf, so went without." "What do I hear?" cried the tailor, and he ran upstairs and said to his son, "Hey, you liar, you said the goat had had enough, and you have let her be hungry." And in his anger, he took a yardstick from the wall, and he drove that oldest son from the house. Well, the next day, when it was the turn of the second son, the same thing happened. He brought the goat to a beautiful garden, and he gobbled up all of the herbs and flowers, and when he asked the goat, "Did you have enough?" he said, "I've eaten so much, not a leaf more I'll touch." Well, then the second son brought him home and said the same to the father. But the father went and asked the goat, and the goat cried, "How should I be satisfied? Among the ditches I leapt and found no leaf, and so went without." "The godless wretch," said the tailor, "to let such a good animal be hungry." And he ran up, and he hit his son, and he drove him out of the house. Well, now came the turn of the third son, who wanted to do his duty. And so he sought out some bushes with the finest leaves and let the goat devour them. In the evening, when he wanted to go home, he said, "Goat, have you had enough?" And the goat answered, "I have eaten so much, not a leaf more I'll touch." "Well, come home then," said this youth, and he led her to the stable. "Well," said the old tailor, "has the goat eaten her full share of food?" "Well," the third son says, "she's eaten so much, not a leaf more she'll touch. She said that." Well, the tailor was distrustful, and he said, "Goat, have you had enough?" And that wicked beast said, "How should I be satisfied? Among the ditches I leapt about, and I found no leaf, and so I went without." "The brood of liars, each as wicked and forgetful of his duty as the other," cried that tailor. "You shall no longer make a fool of me." And quite beside himself with anger, he grabbed that yardstick and he hit the youngest son so much that the youngest son ran away from home. Well, the old tailor was alone now with his goat. And the next morning he went into the stable and said, "Come, I will take you myself to feed you." And he took her by the rope and took her to green hedges and beautiful herbs and said, "Here, you can eat to your heart's content." And in the evening, he asked, "Goat, are you satisfied?" And she replied, "I've eaten so much, not another leaf I could touch." "Come home then," said the tailor. And he put her in the stable. Well, when he was going away, he turned around and said, "Well, are you satisfied this once?" But the goat behaved no better to him, and he cried, "How should I be satisfied? Among the ditches I leapt about and found no leaf, and so I went without." When the tailor heard that, he was shocked, and he saw clearly that he had driven away his three sons without cause. Oh, you ungrateful creature, not only will I, it's not enough to drive you forth, I'll brand you so that you don't show yourself among honest tailors. And in great haste, he ran upstairs, fetched his razor, lathered the goat's head, and shaved her as clean as the palm of his hand. And then he hit her with that yard measure again. Well, the tailor now was quite alone, and he fell into great grief, and he gladly would have had his sons back again, but no one knew where they had gone. Well, the eldest had apprenticed himself to a joiner, and that's someone who makes the little parts of things that join things together. And he learned industriously and indefatigably. And when the time came for him to go traveling, his master presented him with a little table. And this table wasn't particularly beautiful, and it was made from very common wood, but it had one good property. If anyone set it out and said, "Come, little table, spread yourself," that little table was at once covered with a clean cloth, and a plate was there, and knife and fork and dishes, and all the food that you could imagine. It was there to make your heart glad. And the young journeyman thought, "What? With this, you have enough for your whole life." And he went joyously about the world and never troubled himself at all whether an inn was good or bad, or if there was anything to be found in it or not. When it suited him, he didn't even go to inns, but he just stayed in a wood or a meadow, and he took out the table and set it in front of him and said, "Spread yourself," and anything he desired to eat was there. Well, one day, he decided that he was going to go home and find his father, and he came to an inn. And when he did, the guest there said, "Come, sit down, come and eat with us." But the joiner said, "No, I'll not take the few morsels out of your mouth. Rather, come and be my guest." And they laughed and thought he was jesting. But he placed his wooden table in the middle of the room and said, "Little table, spread yourself." Instantly, it was covered with food. Food so good that the host could have never procured it. And the smell of it ascended pleasantly into the nostrils of the guest. "Fall too, dear friend," said the joiner. And the guests, when they saw that he meant it, did not need to be asked twice. And they drew near, pulled out their knives, and ate. It was so delicious, they couldn't believe it. And because every time they finished a dish, a new one would appear. Well, the innkeeper stood in one corner and watched it. And he did not at all know what to say, but he thought, "You could easily find a use for such a cook as that in your household." And the joiner and his comrades made merry until late into the night, and at last they went to sleep. And he set his magic table against the wall. The host's thoughts, however, left him no rest. It occurred to him that there was this little old table in his lumber room that looked just like the apprentice's, and so he snuck it out, and he exchanged it for the wishing table. The next morning, the joiner paid for his bed, took up his table, never thinking that he had got a false one, and went on his way. And at midday he reached his father, who received him with great joy. "Well, dear son, what have you learned?" he said. "Father," said the son, "I've become a joiner." "Oh, that's a good trade, but what have you brought back with you from your apprenticeship?" "Father, the best thing that I have brought back is this little table." The tailor inspected all sides of it and said, "You did not make a masterpiece when you made this. It's a bad old table." "No, no. It's a table which furnishes itself. All I have to do is set it out and tell it to spread itself, and the most beautiful dishes stand on it. And there's wine and desserts. It gladdens your heart. Just invite all our relations and friends. They'll refresh and enjoy themselves for once, because the table will give them anything they want." Well, the father sent for everyone, and when the company assembled, the young man put the table in the middle of the room and said, "Little table, spread yourself." And he waited, and so did everyone else. But that little table didn't bestir itself, and it remained just as bare as any other table. Well, the poor apprentice was so ashamed, and he knew that something had happened to his table, but now everybody thought he was a liar. His relations mocked him, and they all went home without having eaten or drunk. And the father brought out his patches again, and he began to sew. But the son went to a different master in his craft. and left his father again. Now the second good son had gone to a miller and had apprenticed himself. And when his years were over, the master said, as you have conducted yourself so well, I'm going to give you an ass. But this is a very peculiar ass, because it doesn't draw a cart or carry a sack. Then what good is he, said the young apprentice. Well, he spits gold. All you have to do is set him on a cloth and say Bricklebrit, for that's the good animal's name. And he spits gold pieces for you from front to back. That's a fine thing, said the apprentice, and thanked his master and went out into the world. And whenever he needed gold, all he had to do was spread his handkerchief and say Bricklebrit to his ass, and it rained gold pieces. And all he had to do was pick them up from the ground. Well, he traveled the world, but then one day he thought, you know, I better go see my father. If I go with this gold ass, he'll forget his anger and he'll receive me. Well, it came to pass that he came to the same inn that his brother had been at. And he led his ass by the bridle, and the host was about to take the animal from him and tie it up. But the young man said, don't trouble yourself. I will take my gray horse to the stable and tie him up myself. Because, you know, I know like where he wants to stand. Well, this struck the innkeeper as odd, and he thought that a man who was forced to look after his ass couldn't have much to spend. But when the stranger came back, he put his hand in his pocket and brought out 2 gold pieces and said he was to provide something good for him to eat. Well, after dinner, the guest asked what he owed, and the host didn't see why he shouldn't double what he owed him. And he said that he needed 2 more gold pieces. Well, the young apprentice felt around in his pocket, but his gold had come to an end. And he said, well, just wait an instant. I'll go and fetch some money. And he took the tablecloth with him. The host couldn't imagine what this could mean, and being curious, stole after him. And as the guest bolted the stable door, he peeped through a tiny hole. And the stranger spread out a cloth and said, Bricklebrit. And immediately the ass began to spit out gold pieces. Oh, my word, said the innkeeper. Gold, how quickly it's coined here. Wow, that purse would never empty out. Well, the guest came in and paid his bill, and he went to bed. But that night, the innkeeper stole his ass away and put another in its place. Early the next morning, the young man traveled back to his father. And his father was so glad, and he said, what have you made of yourself, my son? A miller, dear father. What have you brought back from all your travels? Nothing but this ass. There are asses enough here. I would rather have had a good goat. Yeah, well, said the son, but it's not a common ass, but it's a gold ass. For when I say Bricklebrit, he spits gold pieces out. Just get all our relations here and I'll make everybody rich. Well, that suits me, said the tailor, for then I won't have to be a tailor anymore. I won't have to sew and my fingers won't hurt anymore. And he ran out and he called all his relations to come and gather and see what his son had brought home. Well, when they were all there, the second son spread a cloth on the floor and said, Bricklebrit. But there was no gold pieces. And it was clear the animal knew nothing of it because he didn't even try. Well, then the poor miller pulled a long face and he saw that he was betrayed and begged his pardon of the relatives who had to go home as poor as they were. Well, both the relatives and his father berated him for his lying, and so the youth hired himself off to a miller. Well, the third brother had apprenticed himself to a turner, and as that was a skilled labor, he was the longest at learning it. But his brothers found out where he was, and they wrote him a letter and told him how bad it was that the innkeeper had cheated them from their beautiful wishing gifts. And so when the turner had served his time and he was about to set forth on his travels, his master presented him with a sack and said, there is a cudgel in there. I can put on the sack, he said, and it may be of good service to me, but why should the cudgel be in it? It only makes it heavy. I'll tell you why, said his master. If anyone has done anything to injure you, all you have to say is, out of the sack, cudgel, and the cudgel will leap forth and display such a dance on the people's backs that they will not be able to stir or move for a week, and it will not leave off until you say, into the sack, cudgel. The apprentice thanked him so much, put the sack on his back, And if anyone came too near him and wished him harm, he said, out of the sack, cudgel, and instantly the cudgel sprang out and hit that person until the young man said, back into the sack, cudgel. Well, meanwhile, he thought, I'm on my way home and I'm going to stop at that inn and deal with this innkeeper. So anyway, he came to the inn and he laid his sack on the table and began to talk of all the wonderful things he had seen in the world. Yes, he said, people can easily find a table which will spread itself, even a gold ass, and things that of the kind. They're all very good, you know, I don't mean to, you know, pick on them, but these are nothing in comparison with the treasures which I have won for myself, and I am now carrying about with me in my sack over there. Well, the innkeeper pricked up his ears. What in the world could it be, he thought. That sack must be filled with nothing but jewels. I ought to get them cheap, too, for all the good things goes in three. For all good things come in three. When it was time to sleep, the guest stretched himself on the bench, and he laid his sack beneath him for a pillow. When the innkeeper thought his guest was lying in a sound sleep, he went to him and pushed and pulled quite gently and carefully at the sack to see if he could possibly draw it away and lay another in its place. The young turner, however, had been waiting for this, and now just as the innkeeper was about to give a hearty tug, he cried, out of the sack, cudgel. Instantly that little cudgel came forth and fell on the innkeeper and gave him a sound thrashing. Well, the innkeeper cried for mercy, but the louder he cried, the harder the stick beat him, until at length he fell to the ground exhausted. And then the turner said, if you do not give me back the table which spreads itself and the gold ass, this dance will begin again. Oh, no, cried the innkeeper. I will gladly produce everything. Only keep this accursed stick away from me. And the young man said, I will let mercy take the place of justice. But beware and don't get into the mischief again. And he cried, into the sack, cudgel, and he let him rest. And the next morning, the turner went home and found his father. And he showed him the wishing table and the golden ass. And the tailor rejoiced. And he said, I have become a turner. And a skilled trade, said the father. And what have you brought back? A precious thing, a cudgel in a sack. What? A cudgel? That's certainly worth your trouble. You could cut one from every tree. But not one like this, dear father. If I say out of the sack, the cudgel springs out and hits anyone who's trying to help me. And look at this. With this cudgel, I've rescued the wishing table and the golden ass, which the thievish innkeeper took away from my brothers. So let's send for them and invite our kinsmen, and I will give them something to eat and drink, and they will fill their pockets with gold in the bargain. Well, the old tailor hadn't much confidence, but he summoned everybody. And then the younger brother said to his oldest brother, brother, speak to the ass. And the miller said, Bricklebrit. And instantly gold coins rained down. And then the youngest brother turned to the table and said to his oldest brother, dear brother, speak to it. And the carpenter said, table, spread yourself. And there was spread with all the types of food that they could ever want. Well, after that, the tailor locked away his needle and thread and never had to go there again. And that's the story of the wishing table, the golden ass, and the cudgel.
Very good.
Yes, you know, you have to do your work, but the world, you know, sometimes you go out and you do your work and then the world just tries to steal it from you. Have you noticed? The smart cookie not to. And of course, it's someone, you know, that's one of the big things. How do we decide, you know, how innocent and naive we should be, how trusting we should be with people? And we need to have our defenses up, you know. It's not about expecting the worst, but it's about knowing to trust your instincts and to look at the world and to understand what situation you're coming into. And, you know, in all fairy tales, it's always the youngest son who wins the day, isn't it?
Yep. Well, you know, you said a moment ago, a smart cookie. Well, I have a story about just such a smart cookie, and she's called the Clever Lass.
Oh, good.
Once upon a time, there was a shepherd. He used to pasture his sheep upon a hill. And one day, he saw something glittering on the opposite hill. So he went to see what it was, was a golden mortar. He took it up and said to his daughter, "I will give this mortar to our king." But she said, "Oh, don't do that. If you give him the mortar, you won't have the pestle, and he's sure to ask for it, and then you'll be in trouble." But the shepherd thought that she was only a silly girl, so he took the mortar, and when he came before the king, he said, "Begging your pardon, Mr. King, I want to give you this mortar." The king answered him roughly, "If you give me the mortar, I must have the pestle as well. Unless the pestle is here within 3 days, your life will be forfeit." The shepherd began to lament. My daughter was right when she said that when you got the mortar, you would want the pestle too, and I wouldn't listen to her, so it serves me right. Have you such a clever daughter as that?" asked the king. Indeed, I have," said the shepherd. "Then tell your daughter I will marry her if she comes neither walking nor riding, clothed nor unclothed, neither by day nor by night, neither at noon nor in the morning, and I won't ask for the pestle either." Well, the shepherd went home and said, "Oh, you can get me out of this. If you go to the king, neither clothed or unclothed," and then he told the whole rest of it. Well, the daughter wasn't one bit frightened. She came with a fall of dusk, and that was neither noon nor morning. She dressed herself in fishing nets. She took a goat, and she partly rode on the goat, and she partly walked. And when the king saw that she had only a fishing net on, that she came with the approach of dusk, and that she was partly walking, partly riding on a goat, he was bound to marry her. But he said to her, "You will be my wife so long as you don't give advice to anyone. But if you do, you must part with me." Well, she didn't give advice to anyone until one day there was a market in town, and a farmer's mare had a foal at the market. The foal ran away to another farmer, who was there with a gelding, and the farmer said, "This foal belongs to me." Well, they went to the law about it, and at last the matter came before the king. And the king, considering that every animal ought to run to its mother, decided that the gelding had had a foal. The farmer, who owned the mare, went down the stairs, saying over and over again, "The gelding is foaled, the gelding is foaled." The queen heard him. She said, "Man, you are talking nonsense." So he told her that he had been at the market, that his mare had foaled, but the foal ran to another farmer who was there with a gelding. "And now," he said, "it has been decided the gelding is foaled." So he thought there could be no mistake. At any rate, he couldn't help it. When the queen heard this story, she said, "Tomorrow, my lord the king will go out for a stroll. Take a fishing net and begin fishing on the road in front of him. The king will ask you, 'Why are you fishing on a dry road?' And you must answer, 'Why not? It's as hopeful as expecting a gelding to foal.' But you must not say who gave you that advice." So it came to pass, as the king was walking along, the farmer fishing on the dry road asked him why he was fishing there. "Why not?" he said. "It's as hopeful as expecting a gelding to foal." Well, the king at once began to rate the farmer. "That's not out of your own head," he said, and he kept at the farmer until he let the secret out. So the king came home, summoned the queen, and said to her, "You have been with me for a long time, and you've given advice in spite of all, so you must go tomorrow, but I will allow you to take with you the thing you like best." It was no good arguing. So the king invited all his courtiers and prepared a splendid banquet. When the banquet was finished, the queen said to the king, "Before we part, you must drink this glass of wine to my health." She had put opium into the wine on the sly. The king drank it in a draught. He fell asleep at once. The carriage was gotten ready, and the queen put the king in it, and drove to her father's old hut. There, she had the king laid on the straw, and when he woke up, he asked where he was. "You are with me. Didn't you tell me that I could take the one thing I like best with me?" The king saw how clever she was, and he said, "Now, you can give advice to anybody you like." And they drove home, and he was king, and she was queen again.
Very nice.
The story of the clever lass. Do you have another, my dear cat?
Well, you know what? I don't. Do you?
I do. I have another. And this is more from the land of legends than from the land of mystical tales. This is an interesting story. It's about the original Hippocratic Oath, hypothesized to have been written by Pythagoras. It began with a promise to Apollo and the demigod of healing and medicine, Asclepius, to honor the one who taught the oath taker and to spread knowledge of the art without a fee. The oath taker also swore to never prescribe a deadly drug or a vaginal pessary to introduce an abortion. Asclepius is believed to have lived about 1200 BC and was said to have been taken from the womb of his mother Coronis after she'd had an affair with the son of a Lapith chieftain from Thessaly named Ischus. When Apollo was informed of this by the white crow, he had his sister Artemis kill her, and then he turned the crow's feathers black, either through a curse or by burning her body in a funeral pyre. The child she had been pregnant with, Aeschylus, was either taken from her body by Apollo performing a cesarean section, or she was given birth to by Hermes, but in either case was given over to Chiron, the stereotypical centaur trainer and raiser of heroes, who in other myths was said to have trained or otherwise inspired Achilles, Actaeon, Aristaeus, Jason, Metis, Patroclus, and Peleus. Coronis's father, Phlegion, was burned in Apollo's temple in Delphi in revenge and was subsequently killed by Apollo. As Asclepius grew up, Chiron taught him how to perform surgery according to the Pythian odes of the 6th century poet Pindar. He was also taught the use of drugs, love potions, and incantations. Asclepius married and fathered 9 children, including 2 sons that Homer said helped heal some of the Greek heroes of the Trojan War. He was killed by a lightning bolt from Zeus for various reasons. In Bibliotheca, written sometime in the first 2 centuries AD, Athena had given him Gorgon blood taken from the right side of the body, which could bring the dead back to life, while the left side acted as a poison that killed. And in this version, Zeus kills him for selling the blood. Obviously a warning to physicians. In another version, he is killed for agreeing to resurrect the god Hippolytus for Artemis. Apollo takes revenge on Zeus for the death of his son by killing those who fashioned his thunderbolts, the Cyclopes, according to Euripides' play. Achilles was forced into servitude for 9 years. Asclepius was later identified by the Greeks with the Egyptian god-man of medicine Imhotep, even though Imhotep was believed to have lived around 2600 BC, some 1400 years before Asclepius, during the reign of the 3rd dynasty king Djoser. An inscription dating back sometime around the first 2 centuries BC in Upper Egypt, called the Famine Stela, tells of how ancient Egyptian King Djoser told in priests of Imhotep to go to Hermopolis on account of a 7-year drought and consult the archives of the temple of Thoth, the god of wisdom, who the Greeks identify with Hermes. Imhotep reports that the Nile had its origins in a land concentrated to Kunun and gave account of the building materials available on the island of Elephantine. King Dozier then had a dream that Kunun promised to end the drought if he would build a temple to him on Elephantine. The common elements of a seven-year famine, the Pharaoh's dream, had led Londoner Emmett Sweeney to argue in his book, The Genesis of Israel and Egypt, that Imhotep and Joseph are the same person, even though Joseph's era, usually thought of to live much later since the Masoretic chronology of the Bible dates him back to 1745 BC. In the very least, it gives evidence for elements of the Imhotep legend being used in the story of Joseph. A reference I'm sure we all enjoy. Asclepius had several medicinal sanctuaries called Asclepians, the most famous one being Epidaurus in the Peloponnese Peninsula of southern Greece, with others in Trikala, Gortys, Pergamon, and on the island of Kos, where the father of medicine, Hippocrates, was born in 460 BC. Non-venomous snakes were used in healing rituals of these temples and left to crawl on the floor where the patient slept. The cult grew very popular in 300 BC. We all remember that. Causing many people to sleep in temples overnight and have priests interpret their dreams in order to prescribe the cure the next day, including visits to the baths or the gymnasium. Zeus, having realized that Asclepius' importance, was said to have created the constellation Ophicus, also known by the Latin name Serpentarius, both meaning snake holder. The title refers to his staff, the rod of Asclepius, which had a single serpent wrapped around it, the ancient symbol for healing. The symbol is similar to that of the staff of Hermes, called the caduceus, showing two mating serpents in a double helix on the winged staff, which in modern times is seen on the back of many ambulances. Although it's traditionally known as the symbol of Hermes, it's also said that Hermes traded the staff to Apollo in return for a virgin nymph named Syrinx. Depictions of the rod of Asclepius and the caduceus are among the most common themes depicted in ancient Mesopotamian art, early Iraq. One of the earliest depictions of the caduceus is on the libation cup showing the caduceus inscribed by the Neo-Sumerian king Gudea of Lagash from sometime between 2200 and 2025 BC. The libation cup is dedicated to Ninjing Zida, whose name means Lord of the Tree of Good, and who in later Kaysite mythology is said to have guarded the gates of heaven alongside Dumuzi. Two griffins, or cherubim, the later Babylonians called them Iamasus, are shown holding giant swords, stand guard on either side. In the book of Exodus, the 83-year-old Aaron throws down his staff, turning it into a snake, and although the Egyptian magicians were able to do the same, Aaron's snake ate the other snakes. In the book of Numbers, even older Moses is said to have healed the Israelites of snake bites by raising up a pole with a bronze snake to heal the Israelites. The Gospel of John makes a reference to this saying, just as Moses lifted up the snake in the desert, so Son of Man must be lifted up, so that everyone who believes in him may have eternal life. For God so loved the world that he gave his only and one Son, so whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life. And with that, I raise my caduceus on high.
Well, you know, the caduceus is also an image of the spinal, of the spine.
Indeed, and of the kundalini.
Yeah, going up, the kundalini going up your back. Interesting,
oh, how coincidental, huh?
Interesting, huh? Well, I think we've done a good amount of storytelling for tonight. What do you think, Lantern?
I think so, too. And listen, I want to have a shout-out to some of the wonderful people that are listening tonight, including the mysterious and wonderful Gwendolyn, whose radio show, Here Be Monsters, is something you should all check out.
Great.
And I want to toast also my dear, beloved Kat. A marvelous journey you took us on tonight, Kat. Thank you so much.
And thank you, Lantern. And everyone out there, please, we hope you join us again next week. 5:30 Pacific time, 8 o'clock Eastern time, and anywhere in between at the Bard's Grove. Well, merry meet.
And merry meet again.
Merry meet again. See you next week, everyone.
Okay. Thanks so much, Kat.
Bye, Lantern.
Bye-bye. see you all next week, and we hope to hear from you. We only have eternity.